Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need. Welcome to the studio, B. Can you introduce yourself to the audience?
Hi, I am a participant in the Crime Think Collective. I've been involved in it for many years. We were hoping to be able to put a couple people on the air with y'all today, but unfortunately you just get me, so although I'll do my best to represent our collective, I want everyone to remember that I am just one of many people who work on this project, and in other circumstances you might be able to get a broader array of experiences or perspectives. But I'm very happy to get to speak with you.
Before I get you to explain Crime Think to people, I want to make note that that is the second time you've emphasized the want to bring on more voices. And at first I thought perhaps it was just because I invited you to bring more people and you thought perhaps like that is how our show operates and that's what we expected. But I can tell by the way you've repeated it to you, it's, and you always correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it has that anti-authoritarian feel already. Like you don't want to be the spokesperson for a collective and a recognition verbally, the recognition of the value of a collective of voices. And I'll tell you, like that's hitting me. I'm hearing it and I'm feeling it and it has significance to me beyond you kind of just apologizing for like, hey, it's just me, you know, like it's not that.
Yeah, I feel like we're always most intelligent and most interesting when we're in dialogue with each other, because between, even if it's just two people, any two people draw on a different range of experiences and a different positioning in the world order that we inhabit. And I think it's always better to hear from multiple people in any collective or any project, even if the project is vertical. You know, if you didn't just hear from the media representative of Disney, but you also heard from the person who has to dress up as a cartoon character every day, you know, you would learn more, right? So everything that we do, we try to be drawing on multiple experiences and drawing more people into dialogue. And at the same time, the way that our project is structured, there are bottlenecks, and there are some people who really want their voices out there, and some people who are more retiring, and the project of trying to distribute agency and leverage over what we do is one of the fundamental challenges, probably not just for our collective, but for humanity in general.
We've kind of jumped ahead. Now we've got to go back. Explain your collective to the audience. Who is we?
Okay, we in this case is Crime Think, which is a decentralized anarchist collective active since the mid-1990s. The first Crime Think projects emerged out of the zine underground in the 1990s, you know, that involved some like punk and hardcore and Riot Girl and some other circles, but a bunch of different self-publishing projects. And a sort of a network emerged out of that of people doing provocative political and discursive interventions, undertaking experiments, you know, people who, for example, were politicized by the sort of do-it-yourself counterculture underground, but came to the conclusion that just being able to self-manage the production of like cultural arts, like, you know, music or literature was not ambitious enough, that what we should really be trying to do is to get control over all of the different factors that determine what our lives will be like. And that's where the commitment to anarchism as a set of proposals about how agency and power should be distributed, how anarchism became important to us. So basically since the turn of the century, we have functioned as a network involving participants in different social struggles all around the world, you know, from here to you know, Russia or Sudan, and we try to give a platform to participants in social struggles, social movements, in different parts of the world and create dialogues between people in different movements, in different places. And in that regard, to sort of function as an institutional memory for grassroots, horizontal social movements. Just to be able to pass on lessons, tactics, strategies, historical experiences, memories from one generation of movements to the next. But, you know, that's the ambitious way to describe it. You know, the other way to describe it is that, you know, we're a network of several dozen people who work together consistently to distribute books, maintain a website where people's reports from different parts of the world can appear. And we're in continuous dialogue about strategy, about what it is that we can do to help really everyone to get more leverage in their lives and reestablish their relationships on an egalitarian basis.
You're our people, man.
Yeah. Aspiring to be.
This is our jam. We're just all smiles sitting here listening to that. Now, you talk about lessons. Folks really should check out their list of books. The show is called Blueprints of Disruption, and that is what they provide, and then some. Now, you say it's a couple dozen people. You guys are putting out a lot of work. It's impressive. The website and the pieces that are being written on top of that are also quite impressive, but I love the idea of it kind of being a written history that's growing, ever growing.
That is important to us. Just keeping our website and all the articles we've published for 25 years online itself is like, hopefully will serve as an archive for people in the future trying to study these events, because a lot of the websites that have been, you know, really important places for dialogue, you know, a place like infoshop.org 20 years ago, or some of the indie media pages are gone. And you can just barely use archive.org to see some of what was there. But for us, we are really trying to think on the scale of decades or aspirationally centuries that we should actually be able to pass on these lessons and keep them accessible to everybody.
We had a guest recently who had a line that really hit, which was, the most valuable commodity that capitalism owns is history. And that just reminded me of that because, you know, having studied history, one term I never really learned about in history class or was anarchism itself. I think it conjures for many people images of the purge and
chaos
and lawlessness, and it's not really, you know, as I've gone to learn about what anarchism is, it's not really at all what it is. And I think that a lot of people haven't had the opportunity to really learn about it because it's not exactly something that, you know, there's been an intentional effort to not teach about it. So, I ask about this early just to feed our conversation as this goes on, but what does anarchism mean to you?
Well, you're right that there are a lot of people who have an interest in misrepresenting anarchism, because basically everybody who desires to be able to rule over others, whatever ideological framework they're coming from, if they desire to be able to rule over others, they're going to be opposed to anarchism, and they're going to have an interest in misrepresenting it. Anarchism, I mean, basically is a set of questions about how to make it possible for people to coexist as equals. And, you know, another way to frame that is that anarchism is the proposal that everyone should have the agency and the power to determine how they fulfill their potential, you know, to determine how they will live on their own terms. And of course, this isn't something that we can do as isolated individuals. We're all part of communities. We're all part of a society and a global, you know, biosphere also, right? So having self-determination has to be a collective project. Anarchism is the idea that everyone should have, you know, leverage over what their lives are, and also that we have to find ways of working together to be able to establish this. It also involves defending ourselves from those who would like to dominate us, and seeing others' well-being as essentially interconnected with our own. You know, since we can't establish self-determination, you know, individual by individual, that's something that communities have to do collectively in struggle. That means that if we're going to succeed in creating an egalitarian society, that's going to depend on solidarity. It's going to depend on us all seeing our freedom as being interconnected with everyone else's. And there are lots of different histories of anarchism we could spell out here. Like you say, history itself is a contested terrain. But for me, the most fundamental thing that we take from 150 years of self-declared anarchist movements is this idea that if we ourselves as individuals want to have freedom, and we don't want that to come at the expense of someone else, that we have to develop an entire toolbox of skills and strategies, both for defending ourselves and for resolving conflicts without recourse to hierarchical powers or oppression.
I have so much to unpack there. I could ask about a dozen questions from what you just said. I think it's important that you drove that point home of the collective, because I think a lot of people have a view of anarchism as being very libertarian because it emphasizes the agency and self-determination, which is not unlike Marxism, right? Owning the means of production and human emancipation. Because, you know, one of the critiques that I often hear about anarchist systems moving forward, not so much the struggle, but as a form of kind of self-governance or systems of distribution and whatnot, is that the most vulnerable would be left behind. Because you can imagine in a libertarian approach, that's exactly everyone fends for themselves. But that point that your freedom can't come at the expense of another, I think is very pivotal there. And I think it's what allows anarchism to really fit into all of the movements, because that is where everybody's going. They may not have articulated it from an anarchist perspective, but surely all these progressives that are working within movements don't feel good about authoritarianism. Generally, that's what they're battling on a whole. They might not know that, you know, like they might be very focused on climate change or passing a very specific law or defunding the police. That's a little closer, right, to anti-authoritarian, yeah. But they don't articulate it that way. And then as such, they're replicating a lot of these systems a little bit, maybe unknowingly, but I think more perhaps from a lack of the tools that you folks have. Not that you've not distributed them well, but that they can't see anything else. Like they know, okay, we've got a party here, just so our audience, the NDP. They're the most progressive choice that most folks think they have. And they operate the same as every other political party, very pyramid structure, they're almost fascist. Like they're just, it's an awful environment. And it's obviously not built towards our goals. But still, some people come out of there trying to do something different, but looking the same. So can you give us some practical tools of like the conflict resolution that you're talking about, or ways that people can move away from authoritarian structures? Like, do you guys have a chair for your meeting? Like, I don't know how detailed we can go, but, you know, is there a few things that you guys would do that would really kind of blow our minds, that are a different way of operating, of creating discourse and coming out of it with a solution?
Well, gosh, I appreciate the invitation to blow your minds. I mean, I'm not sure how unfamiliar the proposals that we have to offer will be to the people who are listening. And that's partly because anarchist proposals and strategies have become more and more familiar over the last 25 years. You know, 25 years ago, when I was sort of cutting my teeth, some of the proposals that were that only anarchists and a few other people were making, you know, whether we're talking about like new ideas about gender or about, you know, sort of rejecting dogmatic nonviolence politics, those were very marginal proposals. And now, you know, after the 2020, the George Floyd uprising in the United States and a series of other movements around the world, the proposals that we have are much more familiar to people. The one thing that hasn't necessarily taken off, you know, is the idea that we should pursue anti-authoritarian relationships systematically, right? Like many more people now are familiar with the critique not only of gender roles but of fixed gender identity in a biological sense. Many more people are familiar with the idea that perhaps it is more destructive not to intervene in the forces that are causing climate change than it is to, you know, break a window or shut down a pipeline or something. You know, many more people are familiar with those ideas at this point, but the idea that we should systematically approach all of our efforts towards political change as efforts to deconstruct hierarchies and redistribute power, that's still a radical proposal. And part of this is because anarchists are often in the front lines of struggles and as consequently are often the first people who are facing repression, you know? And so if you're an anarchist, you're often dealing with, high-level political charges or, you know, getting supplies or, you know, to people who are in bad situations, supporting people who are doing prison terms, rather than just having your hands free to communicate with other people. That's, you know, among the many, many challenges that we face. But in terms of strategies, which is the question that you asked, if I could summarize a basic proposal, a basic way to understand what's common to all of our proposals, it would be that in our movements, as well as in the world that we seek to build, access to power should itself be decentralized. Not just, it should be egalitarian, but it should also be decentralized, because if everybody has to go through a single process to get their voices heard, or to have leverage over what a group does, or to have access to the resources that they need to live, that still will create a sort of a lowest common denominator control over what can happen and over whose voices are heard and whose are not, right? This, what I'm describing will probably be familiar to you from some of your experiences. So this is one of the reasons that that we critique vertical forms of power, like, you know, domination. We don't think that a government like, you know, like the one that Vladimir Putin heads in Russia, we don't think that's a good thing. We also see the ways that self-declared representative democracies, like the one that functions in the United States, also shut out and silence a large part of the population. And neither of those are useful models to base our activist organizing on. You know, in both cases, with our collective, with Crime Think, what we want to do is put resources and skills at people's disposal that people can replicate and use themselves. We want to show ways of accessing resources that understand resources in terms of abundance rather than scarcity. We want to put tactics at others' disposal so that we can make sure that rather than depending on the decisions of an organizing council that may be unaccountable to everybody else in a movement, that people can immediately take action according to their own priorities and their own vision of the world. And the reason that we think this is important is because we think that intelligence arises when you have the input of everybody who is affected by an issue, rather than just the input or the decision-making of one person or one group. We think that if a movement or a network is responsive to the information that is coming into all of the different participants in the movement, that movement will act in more strategic and intelligent ways than a movement that is limited by what a specific group within the architecture of the movement is able to recognize or see from their particular vantage point. That's why we focus on tactics that can be replicated or taken up by anybody wherever they are, and why we try to share information from groups that are employing those tactics experimentally, you know, in particular social movements, so that people in other social movements can learn from their experiences and immediately put those lessons into practice.
One thing that, you know, you comment about lowest common denominator made me think about, you know, when we approach things, for example, from, you know, you hear a lot of people talk about the working class, right, as kind of one of those common denominators. And then, you know, one thing we talk about is how that could exclude people who are not able to work, disabled folks, as an example, right? And, you know, there's a lot of situations where movements leave people like, you know, disabled folks behind and are not properly advocating for them. How does that fit in, I guess, into what you're talking about? To make sure that people like them are not left behind?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, for me, class consciousness is one of the ways that we can describe what we're trying to do, but class is not the only vector of oppression, right? Oppression plays out according to many different vectors. So if we only were thinking in terms of class, that, you know, then you have a framework where you say, okay, what we're trying to do is liberate the working class, which is true, but I would say it's necessary but not sufficient, right? Because for the better part of the last 200 years during which class politics have developed, a large part of the labor that, for example, women do has not been visible through the framework of class. And it's also true what you say about disabled people, and also the precariously employed, you know, the class politics that were useful to, you know, anarchist, syndicalist, Marxist movements 100-some years ago, when the majority of the population, at least of some countries, was engaged in industrial production. Those are antiquated in a time in which more and more people are working in what's called the tertiary sector. They're working in supplying goods and services rather than the raw production of, you know, of industrial goods. And so in this situation where more and more people are precariously employed, a lot of the old strategies, like focusing on organizing labor unions that act in factories, for example, are producing diminishing returns. So, you know, one of the proposals that we've explored over the last couple decades is that we need to understand the protagonist of these struggles as something that is as a population that is broader than just those who are in stationary, stable employment. For industrial unions, for example. Does that make sense as an answer to?
Oh yes,
absolutely.
Oh yes, we had a whole episode on the need, you know, for labor to include social movements and how that can happen because of the certain demographic that they represent and that focus that they tend to have around collective bargaining, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean the problem is that if we only understand labor movements as efforts to you know, bargain for a better deal for those who are in formal and powerful unions, we're leaving out a tremendous portion of those who have to work in other contexts to make money, or those who are, you know, engaged only in what is sometimes called reproductive labor, you know, the unpaid work in the household. So this question came to the fore, for example, during the Occupy movement in 2011, when participants in the movement, anarchists, people who were involved with our projects also participated in shutting down the port of Oakland at the high point of the Occupy struggle. You know, and that was an example of this where the people who actually work in the port, they are in a union. They're in a pretty strong union, but a union in which their agreement forbids them from striking. Right. You know, the general strike in Oakland, the way that it worked to have a general strike, it wasn't, you know, just the formal unionized employees that went on strike. It was all of the excluded, all of the precarious workers that, you know, shut down workplaces, in some cases just from outside, not from their position within the workplace, but from outside of them, and that marched to the port and blockaded the port and compelled the port to shut down. I think that we have to understand, you know, labor struggles much more broadly if we want to be able to wield power in a time when because of neoliberal globalization, workers in Canada and the United States are outflanked by global capital in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and the confines that exist within the labor unions tend to sometimes hold us back. So I want to go back to one of your previous statements because I'm just frantically taking notes and I'm definitely not going to get to digest everything. But Santiago and I were having a discussion earlier today on a statement someone made online. They were really not frustrated, but talking about the need to shut things down. And Santiago and I, we often talk about this, the need to escalate, but also balancing by not leaving anybody behind. And one of the proposals that you speak of is allowing for a rainbow of tactics so that people are being utilized and heard. And you talked about like the collective intelligence, and there's no arguing that, but it's also on the individual level, right? When you give everybody that space to be heard or to apply their energies in the way that they want to, right? Like if that's destructively or that's in dialogue. And when you don't allow that, you start to really create problems within the individual too. And I'd like to kind of maybe have that kind of shut it down discussion, because I'll give you some context. It was a group of people trying to disrupt a meeting, but it's also can be replicated in a march that's going down the street, but only taking up half the street and chanting, shut it down, but not actually shutting anything down. So within these movements, you can tell that there is the appetite for it. And it's always trying to find, I guess, the lowest common denominator here. I'm using that same language in a different sense. Like, so if the most uncomfortable person isn't comfortable with pushing police out of the way, then it's not going to happen. Or if people don't want to look bad and shut down an event that might have other political implications, whatever, then it's just not done because not everyone's ready and we don't want to alienate anybody. And I think in the end, you actually end up alienating those people that are ready to do more, but are being held back. And then at the same time as being held back, we're purposely not giving them the tools. We feel like that's a way of holding them back. Like, just don't teach them how to fight then, or how to stop police violence, or whatever we want to talk about. Because if we do, then we're encouraging it. Like Santiago, we have this battle here internally because we do want to provide tools of disruption, but we don't want to put... We don't want to light a fire we can't control. But I think sometimes... I don't know. Can you help us through that, B, from an anarchist perspective, maybe? Well,
I mean,
fix it.
It's a good question. You spoke about a fire that we can't control. And the fact is that the world that we live in is already being destroyed by a fire that no one can control. Just about everyone acknowledges that climate change is going to produce incredible suffering, especially for people in the global south, but all around the world, and disruption for many people's lives. And yet, neither the economy the free market economy, nor the democratic process, nor any of the dictatorships that exist around the world are able to take action that is commensurate with our responsibilities to try to stave off the catastrophe that is ahead if we aren't able to change course. So I think, first of all, we have to keep that in mind when we are talking about these questions. And so the question is there another way of making decisions that our movements can utilize and demonstrate that will enable us to rise to our historic responsibilities, you know? And of course, I don't think that we should be careless with each other. I don't think we should put people at risk who don't wish to be taking those risks. And that's for ethical reasons. It's also for strategic reasons. If we continuously create situations in which people have bad experiences next to us in the street, it will be harder for us to get together. It will be harder for us to build the kind of movements that we want to. So each of us has an interest in figuring out how to make the ways that we act autonomously, take into account the needs of the others around us. Now, all of that said, at the same time, I think there is a tendency for everyone, wherever they're situated, to think that if they could just tell everybody how to do things and have everyone adopt their preferred tactics and their preferred approach, that everything would work out. I think this is probably incorrect for a number of reasons. First of all, because wherever you're situated, you can't see the whole world. You can't see other people's needs or the problems that they're suffering. But it's also a problem, this way of thinking is also a problem, because we will never be able to impose a single way of doing things on everyone. And to desire the kind of structures that could impose a single strategy on everyone is to desire authoritarianism. So I would propose a different general strategic orientation, which would be, how can each of us act autonomously according to the dictates of our conscience, but in such a way as to maximize the synergy, you know, of our actions and those who want to take a different approach. So what we should be doing is we should be thinking about how to make our own efforts integrate well into a diverse ecosystem of different strategies, different tactics. And that's not something to be imposed from the top down. That's something that we collectively from the bottom up should be trying to arrange. Because it's true, if decisions are being made from the top down or according to a lowest common denominator logic, it's never going to be the right time for everyone to escalate. It's never going to be the right time to shut anything down. It's never going to be the right time to act. And that's because, not only because there are some people who don't feel ready, it's also because there will be people in the conversations who have an interest in preserving things the way that they are, at least for the time being. It'll be, you know, for the same reason that Exxon is like, yeah, I'd like to live in a world without global climate change, but it's just not in our best interest right now to make that shift. You know, if we're, and this was a discussion, I mentioned the Occupy movement in 2011 before, but it's an issue that came up then when we were trying to establish what a sort of democratic process might be. And, you know, people said, well, maybe instead of majority rule, we should use consensus decision-making for our spokes councils. But that creates a situation in which the a spokes council can be prevented from arriving at a strategy for taking action by a single representative of the police, you know? So my argument would be that instead we need ways of approaching decentralized decision-making in which people are concerned for each other's well-being, are thinking, are strategizing about how to take action in a way that is likely to benefit the movement as a whole, and yet at the same time can make those decisions autonomously. And so we need to structure our movements such that some elements of the movement can escalate, can shut things down, can take action. This is something that, you know, anarchists often are the ones who are most likely to be trying to push the envelope, to do things that are...
We know the type. We've seen them in our circles. Yeah. We appreciate them.
And pushing the envelope can take many different forms. You know, it may mean identifying something as a problem that nobody else wants to talk about, like sexism or sexual assault or something within the movement culture. It may be using tactics or strategies that are that seem outré to other participants in the movement. You know, they're like, well, I'm ready to lock myself to something, but I'm not ready to sabotage something, for example. And again, we will never know the benefit or the drawbacks of a strategy unless somebody is able to employ that strategy, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I see you, Santiago.
Well, because here I want to pull from my own experience for a second, because this is, giving me flashbacks to some of my first days in organizing. When I was part of an organization, where an organization that I helped start at the time too, and I even got myself elected in this organization to a chairman position, out of kind of a belief that if I was to occupy that position of power at the time, that I could then not use the power of it and kind of try and decentralize it by preventing somebody who would use the, it didn't work out that way, obviously. But that was my thinking at the time. And I remember, the conversations that we had in this organization about stuff like, sexism, about the fact that it was the majority of the organization was white men. And why is it that this organization is not appealing to a diverse set of people? I mean, this is Toronto, where we're coming from, where it's one of the most diverse cities on earth, right? There was also a lot of talk about, people, myself included, wanted to start actually doing things, actually getting out in the streets and meeting people's needs where they might be as action. And people who disagreed with us, the points that were always made were like, oh, well, that's a waste of resources. We need to have a united goal. And what we need to do is we need to bring people in and we need to take over the NDP, which is, our fake progressive party, right? And everybody has to agree that we are working to take over the NDP, and everybody has to do that. And there can be no multiple objectives. There can only be the one objective, and that is what we're doing, right? And I tried to make the case at the time. I mean, I was very young at the time. I was 20, and still learning how to do all of these things. But I was, I was trying to make the case of like, no, like we go and we, actually show, we prove that we're not just talking, but we prove that we can do something for people, that we have something to offer for people. That's not going to cost us resources. That brings more people into the movement. And I lost that battle at the time, and I left the organization because I got very disenfranchised with kind of the authoritarian nature that it was taking. But I feel like that is, I tell my story because I felt like that from all the things that you were saying. And I think it's a very common story in many ways of the traditional ways that we organize and the traditional organizations, right? That is a common issue. And you hear all the time about organizations who cover up sexual assault within the organization. You hear that multiple times here. You hear all kinds of things. And we don't always it feels like where we don't have good tools to talk about these things and to deal with these things often. I don't even know where I'm going with this anymore, but that's my spiel.
Well, the situation that you're describing is familiar, probably familiar to every organizer who's listening to this, because if you have a logic of centralization and unity rather than harmony that defines how your organization is trying to work, you will inevitably end up in situations where you have to choose between what seems to you to be the benefit of the organization and then, the needs of the human beings who comprise it. And for me, that's an argument against that way of thinking, right? That the benefit of the people within the organization and who are affected immediately by it should not be something that we can ever understand as being distinct from the goals of the organization. First of all, you know, addressing power dynamics inside of a community, inside of a project, there's never a good reason not to do that if what we're trying to address is power imbalances in the world. And at the same time, the other problem with that strategy, from my perspective, is that, you know, if you're like, we'll get control of the NDP or the Democratic Party or whatever, and then we'll fix everything. As you said, you got into a position of authority within the organization, but you discovered that you could only use that authority according to its own internal logic, right? Not according to the logic that you brought, not according to the good intentions that you brought. And that's a structural problem with this way of organizing. In my experience, even when I've been participating in a movement that is trying to change official policy or government policy, the times that we've been most effective in doing that were the times that we demonstrated that people could make the change without the government, could make the change contrary to the wishes of the government. You know, if you're talking about feeding people, if you're talking about housing people, you know, if you show that you can open up buildings and enable people who are homeless to live in those buildings, then the government will be like, well, okay, maybe we could open up some buildings, you know, but if we don't have the power to do that, they will not have an incentive. There will always be something better to do first, you know?
Makes me think of the Black Panther Party, not an anarchist organization, but the Breakfast Program,
exactly.
Which is one that I really admire their community programs. It's something that inspires me quite a bit. That forced the government's hand into having a breakfast program for kids, something that here in Canada we still don't have.
Yeah.
And we have lots of hungry kids because of it.
That demonstrates the value of direct action, and it demonstrates the importance of addressing people's needs directly. You know, and in that regard, the Panthers example is very important and still has relevance today.
If you don't mind, I feel like I keep going back, but
please.
When we're talking about decentralized power, but also decentralized access and application of tactics, right? I want to go back to that consensus versus, I guess most people are in meetings where it's majority rules still. Then there are people who may generally try to build consensus. And from my experience, there were mechanisms where people in certain organizations could object. I think you were talking about that, like a veto, and it could be an infiltrator, a cop saying, oh no, I'm really uncomfortable with this. We couldn't possibly do that. And out of, you know, respect for that one participant, quite often like that idea would then be shelved. And I just, for applicable purposes, for people in those meetings, the idea goes back to the unity versus harmony statement that you made, that let little committees be formed, let actions be decentralized in ways that they don't mess up the whole song. You know, they will be different. That's the idea, right? Unity is the same, or at least we sell it that way. But harmony, if you are in a choir or you understand that, there are different notes being sung by different people with different capacities in their range, right? But it still makes a beautiful sound as a whole, right?
So it might even be more beautiful, yeah.
Yes. And I think as individuals, we have to go into those meetings too, thinking about what you reminded us of earlier. Although we think we have the best ideas, they are not the only ideas. And so we may feel like if that meeting didn't go as we wanted, you know, I really wanted a petition started. And, you know, there's three guys in the back, they want to burn it down. You know, like, let's just use really drastic, you get the idea. Is there a way where we can allow those people that are eager to go beyond a petition to do something with that energy, with those tactics that doesn't malign everything else, but also make the person who thinks that their particular idea can work. Like, I know sometimes resources are limited, so we can't use every tactic that comes up in a meeting, right? Not everybody's idea can always be applied just from a logistical perspective. But it's the idea of coming out of that meeting with not needing to have controlled the outcome, not needing to approve of every idea that will be developed on. And I think, like, sometimes it comes from the individual. Like, we go in with really egalitarian views, but in the end, we want our ideas because they're ours. And of course, we think they're the best one because we sat and we digested them and we came to that conclusion. And it's sometimes hard to think the way that you're describing, that it actually is the collective of ideas that makes the most intelligent choice, but it doesn't have to make one choice, right? It can make many and still be moving forward. Because I think I'm at a point, a lot of us are, we're really frustrated that there is not more escalation in tactics.
Mm-hmm. Also, I just want to give a 20-second anecdote to build on the harmony metaphor, because as a musician, good harmony is actually built on tension and resolution, right?
Yeah, there you go.
So you'll have chords that are full of tension. You know, the notes are actually disagreeing with each other, but then those notes resolve to a balanced harmony, and that gives music the movement that's what creates good music. Sorry, just had to throw that in there.
That's so important. We try to avoid tension at all costs, especially in some of these meetings, right? Like, we'll shelve ideas, we'll deal, like, and that's to, like, take your time. You don't have to rush through everything, but avoiding conflict is a big part of how we teach people to chair meetings as well, right? And how a lot of these organizations are structured, where, you know, you have 2 minutes to speak, and, you know, I don't know, it's really sanitized, and sometimes you got to get it out, right, in a way that doesn't implode and where you don't walk away as enemies. But I think the more we work those kinds of values into the way we organize, the easier it becomes, right, the easier it is to have those tension and we know how to resolve them, and we know there will be a resolve, because when you know it's a zero sum game, it's either your idea or their idea, we're coming out with only one tactic and everybody's supposed to agree with it, you do feel like you lost.
Yeah, and you're less likely to stick around if you feel like you keep losing, right? I mean,
I've left like Santiago, yeah, for sure. And it's stupid stuff. It was like, we need a database, you know, I can build you one, it's nothing, and they're, well, we're not ready for that yet. And I was like, forget it, man. You're going to hold me back on everything. I know. You won't even let me build a database, so I'm out. You're still working off an Excel spreadsheet probably to this day.
Well, and that's an especially tragic example that you're giving, because it was a situation which you were ready to autonomously do work for the group that they would probably, if they hadn't had you at their disposal and needed that work done, it would have been hard to find somebody who was ready to build a database, you know? I mean, and we have to think about all the different capacities that people who have cause to seek social change are not getting to use in our movements. You know, we should not understand those who are in activist groups right now as the protagonists of change. The protagonists of change, it has to be everybody in our society. And there are so many capacities that people out there have that are not plugged into things. And again, if all that can happen is going to be determined by those who have chairman or chairwoman or chairperson positions within today's existing organizations, the things that we change, that will not be all the things that need to change in this society, right? We need to be much more ambitious. We need to be thinking on a much more ambitious scale. Now, Santiago, I thought your metaphor about tension and resolution is really beautiful. And, you know, there are even some beautiful musical compositions, a famous one by Samuel Butler that ends without the tensions resolved, but that's part of the art also, right? I mean, for sure, if we have organizing models that don't offer us the opportunity to explore our tensions, the tensions between us, the tensions within us, then we will not be there as complete people, and we will not derive the benefit of our complete relationships. We will be there as, you know, as sort of partial or as performances rather than as our whole selves, and we will not be able to contribute everything that we want to. You know, and there's, I mean, one of the common anarchist models for organizing is the affinity group, the group of people who agree about something. You form a group of people who agree to try something and they all do it together. But I want to say that is not the only model, because another thing that can be really beneficial is to have like a person that whose intelligence you really regard highly, but who disagrees with you. You know, a lot of the most interesting Crime Think projects have come out of the collaboration of people who did not agree about something, but who valued each other's opinions and said, we'll embark on a discussion about this, and the results will, you know, may not be lowest common denominator, right? They may be like the different points of departure that we can offer to the reader or the user as a consequence of the tensions that the different participants bring. I think that is actually a more useful and fruitful approach to our relationships, to our projects, because the fundamental question that we're talking about here is how do we coexist and collaborate across lines of difference, whether those differences are in our identities and the power structures created by the society, or the differences of ethics or strategy. We actually have to think about collaborating and coexisting across lines of differences as the fundamental thing that we're trying to do, actually, because those differences exist between all of us and within us. You know, if you take an approach just to yourself, which involves eradicating difference, you will be destroying parts of yourself. Even, you know, the thing that we should be doing is making space for everything that can be mutually beneficial to thrive and prosper. You know, so how that relates to organizing, to bring this back to the very beginning of your question, Jessa. I've given a bunch of examples from 2011. I can give examples from other years, from other decades, but I'll give one more from that, which is that I remember in the little town that I live in, when we had the first meeting for people who were interested in doing or in participating in the Occupy movement. You know, there were 100 people in the meeting, maybe 120, and somebody was like, let's establish an occupation in the center of the town. And it was a minority position. You know, if we had had a vote, whether by consensus or by majority rule, we never would have agreed to establish an occupation. But instead, the facilitator said, okay, everybody who wants to establish an occupation, go over here and discuss that. And everybody else can discuss whatever else you want to do, you know? And at first it was like five people. You can imagine just five scary people in black sweatshirts, you know, went over and were standing there just,
right? Is that how we all dress?
Just like, well, you know, just like a bolt of lightning may strike us down now, but I'm going to say we should have an occupation, you know? And not everybody is going to be the first person, you know, to be like, yes, you know, take me now, Lord, you know? But once there were five of them, then there were six, and then there were 10, and then there were 20. That night, you know, 30 people established an occupation, and by 2 days later, all 120 people who had been in that discussion were part of the occupation, right? You know, which it shows the importance of people being willing to experiment and all of us creating containers, you know, for experimentation. And not trying to suppress experiments that don't immediately line up with our own proposals, you know, because it's much better for people to try out tactics, see what they do, and yeah, if there's problems, if they have negative effects for some people, you know, be capable of discussing those, create, you know, processes through which people can come to understand each other better, but never think that the process of establishing the ways that we relate to each other is completed, or that all of the institutions that we need to resolve conflict already exist, you know, because whatever we establish, it will include some people and exclude other people, or it will include some aspects of ourselves and exclude other aspects of ourselves. And again, the anarchist proposal for decentralization is that we should always be taking an expansive approach to the process of decision making and the process of deciding how to look out for each other also. You know, because we can imagine a spokes council that would take everyone's needs into account in some context, but eventually there would be problems that were just invisible to the spokes council, right? And that it was necessary to go through the whole process of thinking all over again what institutions or what processes would be necessary to address everyone's needs. That's, again, one of the fundamental aspects of anarchism is the idea that we are never finished building the political structures that we need, that we always need to be ready to call them into question, to go back and ask new questions, to hear everybody whose voices are not heard in the existing structures or processes, and begin again when we need to.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm probably just going to end the episode there, to be honest, because I think the example that you gave, I'm probably going to unpack for a while after this, but of the facilitator, you know, allowing the five or six scary folks and how eventually everyone came along. And my mind is just going to all the things that happened. You know, those five or six people started off as scary, but they actually made it safe for more people to do something more. And I imagine solidarity played into it. And it's like, you didn't want to occupy, but you're not going to let your friends do it without you. Like, you're not going to leave them to do it by themselves. You came in this together. And so, like, it just made space for movement, for steps forward. It allowed people to step out of their comfort zone too, because I do want to operate where everyone has like their own comfort zone. But at some point we do have to slightly encourage people to expand that comfort zone when they're ready, and like finding ways to do that beautifully, right? Not without tension, but not without alienation either. And I need us all to get there. I'm not feeling very articulate about that at the moment, but just like a whole bunch of yeses. We need to get you folks in front of more people. I can completely understand the need to collect all of this information and the ways you describe them as proposals. It doesn't feel like theory. You know, when you talk about other ways of doing things, it comes across as really theoretical. But this is all very practical stuff, very applicable. And I think we've probably broken down the not stigma of anarchism, but the mystique of it, perhaps, you know? And I think a lot of more people are going to start identifying themselves as anarchists. You know, maybe not with balaclavas, but, you know, like,
we need a bunch of different kinds of anarchism. You know, the balaclavas are important for some people, but shouldn't be necessary for everybody, you know?
No, we do talk about masking up and, you know, taking it safe, but I feel like there's just this image that a lot of people have that will melt away, and so I will stop using that reference because it's not helping. thank you so much. I feel like you're a really good resource to come back to. I don't know if you'd be willing or your other comrades would be willing, but there's so much, like even the piece that you folks did on the human rights discourse around Gaza. I mean, that could be a whole discussion in itself. And I think we've kind of gotten there where, you know, the power comes from the people and not from the institutions. But again, thank you so much for coming on the show. And it has been a wealth, I think, of knowledge for our audience, particularly anybody that is doing organizing or can relate to Santiago's story and the examples that you've given. Thank you, Beat.
Oh, yeah, you're being very generous. I you deserve probably the more, like, a more articulate version of this. But, you know, if you in the future want to, like, to bring people, like, Jonathan Pollock was the person who wrote the text about human rights discourse and what's taking place in Gaza. He's an Israeli anarchist. I don't know if he identifies as an Israeli at this point, but I could probably put you in touch with other people who've participated in our projects who you might be able to speak to about more specific questions. It's just really nice for me to get to talk with anybody who's considering these things. So if I can direct you to other resources at some point in the future, I gladly would.
Well, we will take you up on that offer. We will also, if folks, you're still here, check the show notes. It'll link you back to Crime Think, some of the pieces that we've talked about, and you can check them out for yourself.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That is a wrap on another